Hello and welcome. You're listening to podcast 4 for the lecture on knowledge representation. We resume on slide 57. In this podcast, we will look into some practical aspects of knowledge representation and how description logics have made it into real applications and even standards on the semantic web. So, based on description logics, a language called OWL, the ontology web language, was defined and a W3C standard was established. A very famous ontology based on OWL is DBpedia, and you can actually use it, for example, to put in background knowledge and ontological information into your AI systems. An example of a commercial ontology is Psyche. Work on Psyche started in the 90s and it has been going on since then. Slide 59 summarizes the world of data and current developments. Many of you are familiar with the representation formalisms that are shown on this slide. So we know, for example, all object-oriented programming, which was a very success over the last decades and which allows us to express properties of objects and relate also methods to objects. Interestingly, object-oriented programming also took off in AI research with the language of Scheme. Today, we also see other developments and trends, such as, for example, functional programming language elements that become increasingly popular. And also, AI research was at the forefront of using functional languages, such as, for example, the Lisp programming language, for which even special hardware was built in the 80s. Of course, most of us also have seen relational databases, which are very, very widely used and have enabled to roll out digital solutions at a very wide scale. So deductive databases are now also becoming more popular. So they have long been in the research field, not used so much in practice. But for example, when we state business rules, we use then, for example, also logical reasoners to decide if a number of rules needs to be applied in a business situation. Furthermore, in the last decades, we've seen NoSQL databases taking really off at a very large scale. We have column stores that store attribute value pairs, but we also have graph databases which become interestingly become increasingly successful. Furthermore, there is this development of the semantic web, where we not only simply store information, but actually also associate data with metadata to store the meaning of a data item together with the data item itself. And we want to look into this a little bit in more detail. Slide 60 summarizes the semantic web architecture. The basis for the semantic web are, of course, unique resource identifiers, addresses that allow us to point to specific entities and resources on the web. We usually store information today in the XML format, and based on this, we also use RDF. RDF triples are statements of the form subject, predicate, object. And based on RDF, we can actually start defining ontologies. So we will now look a little bit into the OWL ontology. And a famous editor for OWL is, for example, Protégé, which you can use to build knowledge bases. We will later also then look into the query language Sparkle and get an idea how we can actually query knowledge bases on the web. Of course, we have already seen that to perform reasoning in ontologies based on description logic, we need some logical proof systems. And we have also seen how we can actually do this, for example, using satisfiability checking. We'll now look a little bit further into how OWL is used today. On slide 61, we see the OWL hierarchy. So again, OWL is a family of languages. The full language is undecidable. So we know actually that when we ask a question, we are not guaranteed to get an answer. OWL DL is more expressive than ALC, but is still decidable. And you also see in that there are some equivalent names. So OWL DL is actually based on a language that's called Join D. We see also that there's a language OWL Light, and of course it's based on RDFS. So the reasoning formalisms related, for example, deciding subsumption, are exp time or next time. So we see that actually answering OWL queries is very expensive. However, we also know that there is nothing that we can do much better unless we would lose expressivity, but up to a degree where then the language does not remain useful anymore. So to give you an expression of OWL, take a look on slide 62. So we see here a little A-box, T-box example. So as we know, for example, as we've seen it in ALC, we can express subclass relationships between concepts, such as, for example, that a truck is a vehicle. And we can also express properties of concepts, such as, for example, a truck has an engine, which is a diesel engine, and a vehicle in general has an engine, which is some engine. We can also fill in the A box, for example, by instantiating truck with Ford car, and we can also say that a Tesla has an engine, which is a PC cell. So on the left, you see a summary of the syntax. OWL starts with concepts that we all have seen already in ALC, but it goes a little further. For example, if you look in the middle, it actually has cardinality restrictions. So we can say that, for example, a car must have at least 4 wheels, or we can say a bicycle has at most 2 wheels. We can also state these restrictions over data types. So not only for role fillers and roles that we make some limitations, but we can actually say this about some arbitrary data types. We have data values that we can also use. And to, for example, describe data ranges, we can say that a data range D contains a number of certain data values. So it's one of these values. And we can also here use the inverse roles, which we have not seen in ALC. In the base language, they were excluded. We looked at an example, but we also know that working with inverse roles is actually making reasoning more complicated. So this is a short overview on the language that is available. And you see, or you remember from the previous slide, that actually this language is undecidable. Nevertheless, we are interested in computing subsumption. And let's look a little bit into more details of how we can do this. So, for example, we are interested in class-class relationships. So we want to know if two classes or concepts, C and D, subsume each other. And when we do this between all the classes or concept descriptions that we have, and here OWL more speaks of classes to be closer to what we know from object-oriented programming instead of talking about concepts, but the two terms are synonymous. So when we actually take now two classes and we compute for all the classes in our knowledge base the subsumption relations, then we can actually build this class or subsumption hierarchy. It will look as depicted schematically on the right of the slide. So we get actually a lattice. We have all concepts being subsumed by top, which stands for true, and all concepts will subsume false. So this is what we actually get as the general structure of our class or concept descriptions. Then, of course, we want to know if a given class is satisfiable. So is given a description, is it consistent in the given ontology? So this means it is not subsumed by the bottom element of our subsumption hierarchy. Furthermore, on slide 64, we are actually interested in computing class instance membership. So for example, we want to know if a class is ground. So if we have an individual A, is this an instance of this class in our knowledge base KB? So we have at least one individual which is a member, and this also means that our class is not empty. Given a class C, we also want to determine all individuals which are instances of this class. And given an individual, we would also like to know all the named classes in the knowledge base of which this individual is an instance of. If you remember, we had a little example where we actually looked at a concept subsumption, and we also wanted to know the most specific concept that an instance is an instance of. And here you also can imagine that first we want to know again all the classes to which an individual belongs, and then of course also then go further and determine the most specific class or concept. So subsumption again is key also for practical applications. So we would like to know the class-class relationship between two classes. So remember how we define subsumption. We said that a class C is subsumed by a class D if and only if every model, this means every satisfier interpretation of C, is also a model or satisfiable interpretation of D. And we have four equivalent ways of expressing this relationship. We can say D subsumes C, C is a subclass of D, D is more general than C, and C logically implies D. And here's an example. Cabernet Sauvignon is a red wine. Cabernet Sauvignon is subsumed by red wine, and red wine subsumes Cabernet Sauvignon. So how can we actually compute subsumption? We can, as one method, we can actually do structural comparisons of expressions. We take our class description, put them into a normal form representations, exploiting equivalences, and do compute something that is similar to the normal forms that we've seen in propositional and first order logic, such as the conjunctive normal form or disjunctive normal form. Then we can recursively descend into the structural parts of the descriptions, and we can then compare them to each other. So, for example, if each conjunctive part of C is subsumed by some part of D, then C is subsumed by D. And usually to do this, we often can also here apply graph traversal algorithms. Let's look into some examples to investigate this further. So on slide 67, let's assume that a concept C is described as the negation of the disjunction of two negated concepts. So let's now exploit the relationship of description logic with predicate logic. So we know that actually C is subsumed by D if C implies D. And we can also rewrite the concept description for C as a simple propositional logic formula. We can actually state here that our concept is actually equivalent to a disjunction. So we know also certain equivalences from propositional logic. So here we know that, for example, the negation of A or B is equivalent to the negation of A and the negation of E. We also know that the double negation of A is A. So when we now simply abstract from the proposition or the equivalent predicate order logic representation and just look at the propositional structure of the definition of C, we know in fact that we can simplify this concept to the description A and B. So C is defined as being A and B, and we know that A and B implies A. So this actually means that C is subsumed by D. So let's look at some structural comparison rules for all DL. So when we have given two concepts, we need to define now structural conditions that ensure that A is subsumed by B. So for example, when we have in the concept A an expression that we have an existential role restriction, so we say there is some element in this role relationship R that belongs to the class C, and we have another relationship or existential role restriction expressed in the concept B, then A is subsumed by D if the two roles subsume each other and the two concepts subsume each other. So role subsumption can be stated explicitly in the knowledge base, and it allows us, for example, to express role hierarchies. But we can also compute role subsumption, namely by looking at the interpretation of the roles and seeing that the pairs that actually satisfy one role, or the set of pairs that satisfies one role in an interpretation, is a subset of the pairs that satisfy the other role. So, for example, when we think of a role hierarchy where we say married is subsumed by loves, then in first order predicate logic, this would be equivalent to the expression for all X, for all Y. If X and Y are married, then X and Y, or X loves Y. And we can also, for example, state role hierarchy such as a dog owner is a pet owner. So this actually allows also for then further comparison, and also allows us to express a few more things. So for example, on slide 69, we see here the role hierarchy, which we can actually keep separately in some so-called R box. So we say if somebody owns something, then they also care for it. And in our T box, we can say that healthy beings are not dead. We can say that each cat is dead or alive. And we can also say that a happy cat owner is somebody who owns a cat, and all beings he cares for are healthy. And as owns is a subrole of cares for, we also then know that, of course, he will also care for his cat, and that the cat is actually alive. And in the A box, for example, we can then state that Schrödinger is a happy cat owner, and then also conclude about situations around Schrödinger. So Schrödinger then also means he has a cat, and this cat is healthy, and this also means that the cat is actually alive. So let's look a little bit into how we can do this type of structural reasoning using structural rule comparisons to do some subsumption computations. So slide 70 introduces a small example. We define three concepts. We have a well-rounded company, which is a company whose managers are all business school graduates and who each have at least one technical degree. In a high-tech company, we define that we have here a company that is listed on the Nasdaq exchange and all its managers are techies, and we define a techie as being someone who with at least two technical degrees. So now the question is, for example, does the concept of a cool tech company subsume the high-tech company? So let's look at this. Cool. We define the cool tech company as a company where all managers have business school grades and at least two technical degrees, and the company is listed as at the Nasdaq exchange. So here we use the fills operation or operator and say that the role of this filler for the role exchange is restricted to the Nasdaq value. So when we now look at our previous definitions of the well-rounded company and the high-tech company, we actually see that we have some missing information about these companies. For example, the well-rounded company, we require that it is a company, all its managers have business school grades and at least one technical degree. So, but for the cool tech company, we require actually two technical degrees. So there is no subsumption here. Furthermore, we have no information on the Nasdaq or on being listed on some exchange. So this apparently does not hold. On the other hand, for the high-tech company, we require that it is a company that is listed as the NASDAQ and all managers are techies. And for the men techies, we define them as having two technical degrees. But here we also see that we have the two technical degree requirement satisfied, but we do not have the business school grade stated, and this is missing, but we have actually here the fields information about the NASDAQ exchange. So we see that actually both descriptions have something in common with school tech company, but there is apparently no subsumption relationship. But now the question is, for example, if we take the well-rounded company and the high-tech company and look into the intersection of these companies, could this, for example, be subsumed by two cool tech company? How can we do this with structural reasoning rules? So we start on slide 72 by joining and expanding definitions. So we define this new concept well by putting an and in front and join these two company definitions. Then we expand these definitions by inserting the definition of techie into the former high-tech company definition. This leads to the formula at the bottom. So now we can actually take this concept description and flatten and combine the AND operators. So we have a redundant company information here, but we leave it for the time being. But we flatten all these nested ends. So in fact, we only need one end here that joins the two company definitions. And we can also then combine the information on the manager role. So we actually put in these two exists descriptions into the manager universal role description. Now on slide 74, we remove redundant concepts and we combine operators. So we remove the AND concept, the redundant one, combine these two definitions, and we combine the exists operators. So the requirement that our managers have to have two technical degrees is stricter than having one degree. So it actually subsumes having one technical degree, so we can actually get rid of the exists one. A numeric role restriction, and we end up now with this definition that you see depicted here in the middle of the slide. So the intersection of the well-rounded company and the high-tech company is a company where all managers have a business school grade and at least two technical degrees, and this company is listed at the NASDAQ exchange. And now we actually see that this is equivalent to the cool tech company. So the two concepts actually subsume each other. So let's look at another example what structural comparison rules can do. So let's here look at the definition E of a company where all managers have a business school grade and which has to be listed at some exchange. Furthermore, we're given a definition D of a company where all managers have a business school grade, they have two technical degrees in addition, and the company is listed at the NASDAQ. So now we know that actually the requirement on the managers of concept D is more specific than the one on concept E, and there we actually have an implication relationship. So this is already on the good side. But the question here is the exists and the fills relation on the exchange role. So we have in concept D an information that D is a company that is listed at the NASDAQ. So here we have a specific object given. And for company E, we only require that it must be listed on some exchange. And here we need, in fact, a specific rule. And you see this rule stated at the bottom. So in fact, in this case, actually that being listed at NASDAQ implies that we are listed at some exchange. So this is very natural. So this actually means that D is subsumed by E is true. But you see that actually for all language constructs that you have in your description logic knowledge base, you need to have these specific rules, and you must really carefully study based on the relationship with predicate logic, which of these relationships between the various syntactic constructs holds. So this is not so practical. One can do this by putting actually a calculus together that then provides us with all these structural reasoning rules, but we would probably not do this today. So slide 76 summarizes this, and actually we have a much more convenient and very general way of doing this today by using a satisfiability checker. So we want to know that if a concept C is subsumed by a concept D, we need to show the logical implication between these two concepts, and we can actually also prove the opposite, that the concept actually follows, or this statement C implies D follows from the knowledge base if the opposite is not entailed by the knowledge base. And we can actually add the negation to the knowledge base and actually prove that we end up with a logical contradiction. So today we would probably use a SAT checker to do this very efficiently. However, let us look a little bit on practical applications on slide 77. So we have our ontology language defined. We have now various ontologies on the internet, and now we would like to do some queries. So we would like to query information about or over these ontologies. So what are the principal problems that we encounter? So the basis for our ontologies is RDF. So we have these subject, predicate, object relationships that are stored in a massive way in these stores. And we can actually do this about all kinds of domains. And you can, for example, take a look also at the American data that is published. And you see lots of ontologies with all these informations, and RDF stores are actually available on the web and can be queried with Sparkle. So in these stores, we do not have T-box information, but we have represented large A-boxes, and they can, for example, look as depicted on slide 79. So here we actually know, for example, that a person, Kurt, lives in Cambridge. Kurt owns an object, which is a car. The car was made by Ford, it was made in Detroit, and Detroit is a city, and so on. So we have here type information, and we have instance information. So we know information about specific individuals, such as Kurt, car 0, and Ford, and Detroit, but we also have types such as city and car. So now we can actually use the language Sparkle to query such RDF stores. This is depicted on slide 80. The small graph contains, in fact, 7 triples. Kurt knows, owns a car. The car is a car. This car was made by Ford. The car was made in Detroit. Detroit is a city, and Cambridge is a city. So, for example, if we now want to find all persons who own a car that was made in Detroit, we need to take the 7, like the graph that we've shown on the previous slide with all these 7 triples, and actually look at a subgraph contained within this graph. So we come in with a subgraph that actually contains query parameters, variables. So we have the variable person, and we have the variable person, and now we want to match this against the 7 triples graph that we've seen on the previous slide. So this then all actually should help us to find all persons who own a car that was made in Detroit. So you see this actually on slide 81 illustrated. So we come with this query graph and match this now against this triple store. And we immediately realize that we actually have here a subgraph matching problem. So we want to take our query graph and match these nodes with the variables to instances or objects that actually are of the corresponding type, and then want to actually follow these links in the graph or edges and see if then the Detroit and car information, for example, is then correct. And here we actually see that Kurt, for example, and car zero were valid matches for this query graph. Unfortunately, subgraph isomorphism is NP-complete. So for an arbitrary graph, we cannot compute it in polynomial time. We want to look for a mapping, a function that somehow matches the vertices of the graphs in a way such that these edge relationships also match to each other. For fixed patterns of graphs with a given number of vertices L, we can do this in polynomial time. But you see that the polynomial actually grows very heavily when we have more vertices. And this is then also prohibitive in terms of computational resources. For simple forms of graphs, for example, if graphs planar, then this can be done in linear time. So in general, but to answer the query, we need to bind the variables in the query to nodes in the data graph such that the query clauses align with the data triples. And this is again illustrated on slide 83. So Sparkle actually allows us to formulate such graphs. And you see here one example. It is of a little bit oriented on normal database query languages such as SQL. You notice also perhaps the similarity in the name. But of course, it allows us to express statements over these triple stores and ontologies. And the language is very expressive. So we can actually define, for example, various data sets from which we want to collect the information. We put this into the select statement, and then after the where keyword, we actually put our query pattern, and we can also have a lot of query modifiers then added. So we don't want to go into detail here, but look at some examples. So you can actually do quite some complex query patterns, for example, joining the results by matching the values that the variables have in common. You can compute the union and also computing negation. So for example, you only include results from solving A that are not compatible with any of the results from the pattern B. So this actually makes this language very powerful, but also very hard then to compute. And this is an own area of research, how we actually can do this effectively. So let's look into the problem of when we have various ontologies joined or linked on the semantic web. And we have now a query that wants to query multiple triple stores. So this is depicted on slide 86. So we have these so-called named graphs. And now we actually look at the relationship of these subset or parts of these graphs and actually join the results from the various distributed triple stores. So to do this, actually, we have several possibilities. So let's look on slide 87, and I want to briefly summarize this at the end of the lecture. So if we want to distribute a query over multiple triple stores and somehow join the results, we can do this in four different ways. First, we can actually query the semantic web and integrate the distributed stores into our own triple store. So this means we copy then the relevant stores and integrate it all together. We can also use issue follow-up queries. So we match against the first ontology, we get some values back, and now we use this to instantiate our query variables, and with these values then we do follow-up queries in other stores. We can use something that is called query federation or something that is called automatic link traversal. Let's look a little bit at what this means. So building a local store is, of course, reducing the problem to querying a single store. However, we must carefully integrate all these triples, and it must also be up to date. So this means all the time we need to do updates, and we need to also deal with the problem that we may have inconsistent information. And then the question is, what is then the integration of this inconsistent parts of the ontology. With this, let me end this podcast.